Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Nicole Archer. I teach at Montclair State University, and I she her pronouns. So.
It's fantastic to see you. I think we just worked out that we last saw one another. I think it's almost 16 years ago. I think it was the summer of 2008
Yeah.
when we
Wow.
met. We were in a seminar together, and you were one of the outstanding contributors. I thought to that, I really enjoyed being in the seminar, and you were just fantastic. So it's a great privilege and a treat for me that we're back together gossiping again. And
Very kind.
Prof. Archer, I'd like to begin, as I generally do, by asking you about whatever it may be that is currently dynamizing, enchanting, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Well, these days, I think in 2024, like I said, I'm at Montclair State University in New Jersey. I live in New York City, so I'm locating myself in the United States, and the US election obviously is something that's taking up a lot of my headspace, in part because it lines up with things that I think about in terms of my research, but also just because I think it's hard not to connect many things to the upcoming election here right now. So and how that will play out in all kinds of international politics as well. Trump just started his hush money case here in New York City. So, it's everything from seeing tons of cops everywhere, literally in the city that I live in, because of this, all the way to the news and everything like that. But I would say, the upcoming election is probably the thing that keeps invading my thoughts, even when I try to think of other things. So, yeah.
And as you imply, Prof, when you refer to the international implications, of course, at another level of sophistication, a lower level, or at least a different one, people outside the US are probably equally preoccupied. And I wonder if you could focus in for us a little bit on the implications that election has for your own work.
Well, for my own work, I teach art history and design theory and feminist and queer theory. I come from a background in art history and cultural studies. I was a grad student in cultural studies essentially when I met you. And my own work is on the material culture of like the contemporary right these days mainly. So, and also the material culture of patri excuse me, the material cultural culture of patriotism in the United States these days. So, I have been thinking a lot about this from the last election all the way through, but I'm looking at like literally how, people focus a lot on digital culture and the way that misinformation and all kinds of things are spread through digital media, and rightfully so. But I've been quite interested in the way that, right-wing politics in particular are kind of materialized and made real through material culture. So, right now, I'm just looking to see like how that's happening, what sorts of rallies and protests and things like that are beginning to bubble up again, what types of new forms they're taking and things like that. So in terms of tying it to my research, I would say, I'm quite literally tracking that. And I also track the kind of feedback loop between the digital and the analog, kind of like what are the differences and similarities between those things. So, that's kind of a little bit of what I mean, which means can mean everything from like literally seeing what types of t-shirts are being sold outside Trump's trial, to what sorts of flags are trending on Amazon these days, when and things like that. I have a longstanding interest in labor politics in the United States, particularly within the textile and needle trades. And so I have focused, I should say, on the kind of material culture that is textile based. So, and thinking about not only how people use these objects performatively and how they trade them and what they're, the different ways they're used, but also how they're made and how the kind of process of making does or doesn't kind of align with the politics they espouse. So, yeah.
So, I'd like to learn about at least two of those things, but I'd like to begin, if we could, with January 6, 2021, infamous day, Sedition Day, as it should be known, amongst
Absolutely.
other titles. And of course, on other occasions, I might be all favor of sedition, but not by those
Not
parts.
this one, I guess.
And one of my themes, obsessions, interests is the way in which the rhetoric, the norms, the material culture, the actions of progressive social movements have been taken up, infiltrated, appropriated by the right very successfully. And it seemed to me that part of what went on that day was costume,
Oh, for sure.
particularly the dude, the one, I mean, I can't remember his
That
name.
with the horns and
Right.
the kind of
And
Celtic, forget about Celtic.
right.
Okay, or
He's
Nordic.
become, in some ways, the image that day, along with people dying, people suffering, people injured, people frightened, people screaming, in more general terms. And so I wondered if there's something you could decode about that guy and what he looked like and that kind of white masculinity that he was embodying.
So forgive me for not having his name on Instant Recall.
I'll look it up while you're talking.
But yeah, I mean, I think obviously one of the things that he, I mean, there's different modes of costume that peppered the insurrection, right? So
Jacob Chansley,
okay, Jacob Chansley.
QAnon shaman.
Oh, that's right. That's and the shamanistic element is kind of, it was according to him a big part of it. And it is something worth paying attention to. So okay, so there are different types of modes of costume that we saw like really prevalently on January 6th. And yes, I do think he becomes, for lack of a better term, maybe the poster boy of it, because his costume was so photographable and so extreme and things like that. But obviously, with the ties to QAnon and things like that, I mean, there's explicit kind of white nationalism that I think that costume speaks to, because of whether or not it's true, like it's kind of claims to this kind of Northern European mythological kind of shamanistic. I mean, that's the form of shamanism, right? Like that they're kind of thinking of, and I think then of course there is the kind of bare-shirted, if my memory is correct. I don't have an I th I the image of him sticks out in
He
my
was
mind,
showing
but
his cleavage, Prof. He was showing his cleavage to
yes.
us.
So no, he wanted us to see his body, right? Like he wanted us to see him in all of his full glory. And then his face was painted, which also speaks to like traditions within, you could say, shamanism on one hand, but American athletic culture on the other hand, right?
Yes,
So
couldn't he have been a frat boy at a college football game?
yeah, I think he could have. But and then he brings in the shamanistic kind of element. And I think this is part and parcel of a lot of the QAnon stuff that we need to take seriously, which is it's, a group of people who really believe they have access to a kind of knowledge that we don't have access to. It's epistemological. It's a really interesting, devious kind of epistemological project, QAnon, I think. People desperate for information, drowning in information that digitally, but excuse me, I should say desperate for knowledge and drowning for information, and would really be the way to put it. And I think one of the things that I find kind of fascinating about QAnon and the aesthetics of QAnon is they're desperately searching for like hidden meaning, in the signs of pizza restaurants or horns on some guy running around, Washington DC or whatever. But like they it's super narcissistic. They believe that they have access to the special information because they're special. They dress according and they read the world according to this like really convoluted code. You need a deciphering, what is it, a code written or to figure it all out. But anyhow, his costume, I think, is part and parcel of that. And forgive me for not having an image of, but I think, the numbers that, they dress in, the colors they use, the symbols that they, but in his case, I wouldn't be surprised if many of the symbols were even straight out of white nationalism. But Yeah, the other costumes that we saw were either militaristic or colonial, quote unquote, revolutionary, quote unquote. And then, just kind of print tees and things like that. But in order to kind of align people with whatever region or group they came from. But yeah, there was a lot of very performative politics going on January 6th. So,
I
yeah.
guess it compromises too, as do so many other things, the notion of the Republican Party as the party of law and order. It's not at all,
No, not at all.
whatever else it may be. Prof, moving on to the other point you made, and I'm sure we'll go back to right-wing material culture about labor, about the work of needle and thread, and of making textiles. Could you share with us a little bit about that, about what that means in the United States, and also what it means for people outside the United States working to produce materials for the global North in Europe, in Japan, in South Korea, it's, and the US? Because what people may not know is that there's a huge, deeply oppressed, often female, often migrant proletarian culture in LA, in New York, etc., making garments.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially garments. And we don't think of, I think, right, not to completely sever the conversation from January 6th. I don't think we think of right-wing political culture in terms of fast fashion, but we ought to, because the t-shirts that they turn out constantly, they turn out at a similar clip, because they're very slogan and motto and event driven and things like that.
Oh,
So they also
interesting.
have really quick
Ah, so
turnarounds.
their political economy
Yeah.
relies on the exploitation of labor.
Absolutely. That's the only way that we can have that material culture
Beautiful.
available as quickly as these events need them and stuff like that. And it's interesting, official merchandise sold through so to get to some of the nitty-gritty of it, and then we can speak more broadly about this, but just to stick with the political material, anything that's officially a part of, I believe, like, let's say the Trump campaign or any political campaign needs to be made in the United States. And then when it's made in the, because we have laws in place that say we have to source, certain goods. If it's, well, I should say it's double-edged. Most politicians will do it for the sake of having the made in US label. It's not officially that they have to do it. If it's a government purchase, then they absolutely officially have to go through US source. In either case, there is a variety of different types of factories that the stuff is going to be coming from. And the faster, less expensive, more, I don't know, let's call it politically trendy merchandise is going to come out of factories that are subcontracted by subcontractors and subcontractors and subcontractors, right? They don't necessarily follow, I don't want to say none do, but generally speaking, they don't follow US labor law, and they hire the most kind of marginalized workers, right? People who are undocumented and live under the fear of being reported, people who, are just living in very precarious situations for any number of other reasons too. So that's the stuff that's sourced in the United States. But the amount of material that we see flooding the U.S. consumer market, both in the right wing politic, political kind of milieus, and now just more broadly, American appetite for like clothing is just ramped up exponentially, and that's a global supply chain that's feeding that. That's the whole race to the bottom kind of phenomenon that many scholars have spent a lot of time talking about. But basically very little textile production that happens for cheap or affordable, quote unquote, clothing, garment textile production happens here in the United States. It's imported in stuff that's made here in the US can feed fast fashion because we need to have quick turnaround, but those are going to be the hyper exploited factories. The kind of more quote unquote professionalized above board factories are going to make higher priced goods and things like that. I'm not sure if that quite answers your question.
No, I appreciate the correction. I mean, when I lived in LA, American Apparel was a big deal,
Yeah.
but it sort of went bust and then was bought, and it doesn't
Oh.
have that huge factory in the Arts District of LA anymore, right? It's offshore now, I think, for
Yeah.
example. Would this be an instance of this?
Yeah. So I spent a little time working in Los Angeles with this incredible organization that's still in Los Angeles, still representing the workers in LA, the garment workers in LA, called the Garment Worker Center. So anyone interested in directly kind of working with workers in LA should consider looking at that organization. But yeah, at the time, American Apparel was there. But m the vast majority of factories in Los Angeles, and now last time I worked in Los Angeles was like 2005. But what I've tracked since then is, most of the factories are these subcontracted factories. The Garment Worker Center in particular was founded after a group of workers were discovered literally chained to their machines, working in, under slave conditions, not even low wage conditions. These are undocumented workers who are working off their passage, quote unquote, to the United States. But, the factories in LA, for instance, use all kinds of really, hideous and systematic ways of keeping workers unaware of the rights that they have, regardless of whether or not you're documented or undocumented, whether or not you have the legal ability to work in the United States. If you're working in the United States, you're covered by U.S. labor law, plain and simple. And a lot of these factories just isolate their workers in any number of hideous ways, as extreme as literally keeping them captive, but also having workers work alongside other people who don't speak the same language as them, so they can't organize and stuff like that. So that younger workers aren't necessarily the pro younger meaning more recently kind of workers who've more recently started to work at the factory aren't around workers who have maybe been there longer. So people don't stay in these factories very long. They're often shuttled around. But there's all kinds of ways to stop people from organizing and lining up with places like the Worker Center in LA to stop them from attaining their rights. And then, quite honestly, they're LA is the main place where garment work still happens in the United States, and there's very pe few people who can even enforce the law. At the time I was working in LA, I want to say there were maybe two people assigned to the entire textile and clothing sector in Los Angeles. And then the other thing that's happened in LA to make it an even more exploitive working situation is it used to be that downtown LA had a fairly large concentration of factories. But with the gentrification of Los Angeles, a lot of the places that these factories once occupied have been taken over by housing for more affluent Los Angelians. And that has caused an industry that at least at one point people benefited from just being in proximity to one another, and worker centers benefited from being able to speak to workers in more concentrated ways. Now people are much more dispersed across this large, large city.
It's a demoralizing story, isn't it? And if you go and look at work outside the United States, especially in, off the rack slash fast fashion, you see extraordinary exploitation monetarily. And the vast majority of this exploitation is of women. Is that still fair to say?
It's generally fair to say. I mean, what I would say is that men do work absolutely with, I mean, in the United States, of course, you have people of all gender expressions working in the industry, but yes, I would say most people probably identify as women. But there are, and in many areas, absolutely. And the trade is incredibly gendered, but international trade is incredibly racialized and is marked with like histories of colonialism and things like that. And it isn't just a matter of gender. And depending on where a factory is, it might be the only industry available. And in that case, what might happen is, and again, this is very contingent on where we're talking about, what the cultural, political, and industrial conditions are there. But what you might see is quote unquote homework might be done more by women, whereas factory work might be done more by men. I'm speaking in a broad generalization here, but the more kind of industrial scale stuff, sometimes you might actually see more men in the factory. really is dependent. But yes, I would generally say it's fair to say that we're looking at the exploitation of women.
And one of the other issues here in gender terms is that I've read, and I'm not an expert unlike you, that the vast majority of fashion expenditure is on women's clothing, particularly at the top end of things, but more generally. And it's always interested me that in the global north, but also places in the global south where I've lived, a haircut costs a woman more than a man, and possibly she's got more hair. A pair of shoes costs more for a woman than a man, and probably fewer materials are going into that object because it's probably smaller. Right? I mean, obviously, this is speaking in very traditional gender terms, but that's what the nature of this industry is, seems to be.
Yeah, it's a huge part of making gender, like normative forms of
Right,
gender.
it's not just a response to it, it's an incarnation thereof. Could you speak a little bit to that, to the importance of women's fashion to international capital?
Oof, yeah. Well, I think, again, to speak broadly, consumption is super gendered, right? Like, so, early histories of consumer societies, it was the role of, women, again, of the upper classes first, maybe, to consume, right? The story's been told by many people that, it was kind of an important form of cultural work and social kind of status for a woman to be able to display the wealth of her family on her body and things like that. And there we have like all the kinds of and then from there we can go through like different forms of conspicuous consumption follows and all this type of stuff. But consumption's gendered, right? Like it was geared towards women early on, and department stores were built as women's spaces and things like that. And women were trained to consume, socialized, I should say, socialized to consume at a certain rate that was greater than men. And it continues to today, absolutely, 100%. And so I think, consumption is a key technology of gender, is the way I would answer that. And I think with all the exciting changes that younger generations are kind of proposing to the gender binary, it behooves younger generations to consider changing consumption patterns if they want to change gender patterns, because gender continues to be incredibly, excuse me, consumption
Sure, sure.
continues to be incredibly gendered.
Focusing on issues of race and gender. If one looks at the history of authorial clothing design for women in the 20th century and the 21st century, again and again, it's white men, often queer, in Western Europe and the United States who are key figures. And to a certain extent, the same if you look at classical Hollywood. Edith Head, a very famous clothing designer, but Adrian would be perhaps not quite as famous, but almost as a classical and queer designer. So there's something there about gay white masculinity dressing women at the top end financially of things. Is that fair to say? And what does that signify?
It's interesting. I mean, I do think that, the gender sexuality knot is going to bring people who kind of are either actively critiquing or just like living and breathing a different kind of, relationship to gender and sex together in different ways. I'll say this. There's a fashion designer that I've done a fair amount of research on, Rudi Gernreich, who was a really big mid-century designer and a founding member of the Mattachine Society. So a kind of pre-Stonewall gay rights organization for people who don't know the Mattachine. And he explicitly used fashion as a tool for feminist liberation. He would say this in interviews and things like that. It was, he believed, part of his responses. So to speak, not for Rudi Gernreich, but through Rudi Gernreich, let me say this.
Yes,
Here
yes.
is a queer identity, although he never quote unquote came out of the closet because it was kind of a different time then. He didn't. He lived his life. He was, he was queer. But and he was a member of the Mattachine and all. But he didn't come out officially in his life. But he is a gay man and a white man, but an immigrant who fled Europe, a Jewish immigrant who fled Europe under the risk of Nazism and stuff like that. He saw fashion very explicitly as a kind of social technology, and he believed as, and I believe as a gay man, that part of his responsibility as a fashion designer, particularly in the 1960s, 70s, as like feminism, women's liberation start to become more and more prominent. He took it upon himself as like a responsibility to use fashion as a tool to help liberate women.
Yes.
Now, interestingly enough, he designed mini skirts and clothing with like cutouts and very, what you might call body positive kind of things. But it was this idea that like, the woman's body should be just, able to move and do whatever it pleases,
Yes.
and he, yeah, I think he recognized that there was a kinship there between himself as a gay man and women who did not want to be kind of conscribed within certain kind of gender norms, let's say
Right.
that. And so you can play that out to say that, yeah, there's this consciousness more broadly. I mean, he's an example of someone who does it in the name of liberation and a more leftist kind of politic. But yeah, I think people come together because they find themselves the boot of patriarchy on their neck one way or another. And and these men do this. Now, in terms of the question of whiteness, and how that figures within all of this, I mean, I think within the United States, to be a fashion designer still requires a lot of capital, and racism is a huge issue. I don't know, I think, to be as plain as that, but I think that probably accounts for why so many of these designers are white. But there are many amazing Black male and female and designers who identify otherwise, historically and still to today, who helped shape the look of many women, but maybe not on such a mass scale as someone like a Gernreich or an Edith Head, who's a costume designer who you mentioned earlier.
I guess if we think about the period from the 30s on, Paris, Milan, New York became centers of this, right? And have continued to be, albeit, of course, there are thriving international fashion designers for women from Africa, from Latin America, from Asia. You name it. But these centers still tend to take the attention. So Vogue might appoint a black editor and might have black women on the cover, but they're on the catwalk or whatever it's called in Milan, in London, in New York, in Paris, in order to get that attention. Is that right?
I mean, I think broadly it is. I think mediascapes are still, yeah, centered in some of the same places, and this is a form of cultural imperialism, that's been working for a really long time, and people aren't quick to give that over. But I do think fashion is more globalized now than it has been. Part of that's because the supply chain has so much more globalized. I think also consumption has changed a lot because of the internet and things like that. More and more people are consuming online and through private label retailers, not all going to these kinds of large department stores that will curate, the designers from certain kinds of metropolises and things like that, then produce an image of a, I don't know, a Nordstrom woman or a Saks woman or whatever. But I think things are changing. But yeah, I think absolutely fashion with a capital F, is absolutely, still a major driver of certain kinds of cultural imperialism. That's
And
absolutely true.
what extent do things to magazines like Vogue matter anymore? Are they still really crucial? You mentioned the internet as being very important.
It's interesting. I'm not a media scholar, so I don't want to make claims I can't back up. But I do think, things like Instagram and TikTok are way more important these days. Just from, in my school, we have a fashion design and merchandising program, and I've learned a lot from just working alongside my peers in that program, and advising some of the students in that program. And, I think, within the different media scapes that, comprise the contemporary fashion world, of course, like a Vogue still has a pretty major role in it. And they also have their digital kind of footprint and things like that. But, with the rise of influencer culture and stuff like that, I think online kind of, what is it called? Producer content or producer made content and stuff like that is having a huge effect. And I don't know that the magazine has quite the
Are
same.
you saying that Anna Wintour has to take her sunglasses off?
If only I wish. Yes, I am saying that. I am
That's
saying
bold. That's
it's
bold.
time. Yes,
Now,
exactly.
speaking of academic disciplines, your education has been in part in art history. What do art historians, and you've been involved in the College Art Association and so on, make of doing things like looking at the political economy of labor in making garments, for example? I mean, is this something where they throw up their collective hands and say, "What is that girl doing? What is Prof Archer up to? We don't get it." What do they say? "We love you, but come back to us."
It's funny. I for a long time, so I did study art history as an undergraduate. Then I went to the UK to study visual culture and cultural studies because I had this kind of orientation towards material culture. And then finally, I landed an interdisciplinary PhD here in the United States at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Always grounded in art history and always knowing that I wanted to teach in art and design history, because that was just a place I thought I could do some interesting work. But yeah, I think, beyond this run-of-the-mill imposter syndrome, I always wondered whether or not I still wonder whether or not I am a quote unquote art historian. But to your point, yeah, I am currently on the board of the College Art Association. I'm about to take on the role of VP of Publications for the College Art Association. And I
Oh,
was, and I,
congratulations to
yeah,
them
thanks.
and to you.
And I previously served as the editor-in-chief of Art Journal Open for the College Art Association. So all of that to say, when they invited me, this all started with that role, the editor-in-chief of Art Journal Open, which is Art Journal's sister, kind of open access publication. And I was invited to apply for that role. The first thing I said to them when I was being interviewed was, am I the Did you this Nicole Archer, or is there a Nicole Archer you're looking for? Because I wasn't sure that I
Oh, that's
was
very good
doing
imposter
the kind of
syndrome.
work that
That's
they,
classic
I
imposter
was like, what
syndrome,
is this?
isn't it?
No. But I think art history's finally come around on visual culture, so to speak. No, I think art historians are very aware that this is work. This is the discipline that TJ Clark helped make. This is the discipline that, so many amazing social
Griselda
artists,
Pollock.
Griselda Pollock, Rozica Parker, have done some of that work. I'm looking at my shelf right now because for the life of me, I can't remember this one early art historian that I absolutely adore. Anyhow, so social art history has always been a thing. It
Linda
just
Knopfler.
felt, oh, Nochlin for sure. Yeah, no,
Nochlin, sorry.
absolutely. I mean, art history as social history has always been a thing, but it fell to the wayside for a while because of the rise of the importance of formalism and certain types of theory, and theory that strangely enough didn't think it had to reconcile with political economy. So yeah, there was a minute there when the types of things that I did didn't seem legible. That's honestly the reason I didn't do a PhD in art history. I didn't think I could. I thought I had to go to a program like the History of Consciousness to do it. If I were to go get a PhD today, I actually think I could. Based on the work that, a lot of people are doing in those departments. And I think, art historians have done a lot of work over the last couple decades, accounting for the role that they have played in all kinds of complicated politics. The role, I mean, art history can be an instrument of white supremacy. Art history can be an instrument of colonialism. Art history can be an instrument of all kinds of, class, forms of classism and stuff like that. And I think, the last few generations of art historians who Inachlin was always already there for us, right? Or something like that, have come to not only accept that we can do that, but feel like we must do that, to keep our discipline relevant and meaningful, at a time when they're coming for us, like our departments are shutting down, if we can't prove the relevance of our discipline to the world today, then there's gonna be no saving us. So,
Well, this is the duality that it seems to me much of the humanities in the United States in particular is. But in all the Anglo countries, because they were always behind the curve intellectually and politically, in good ways and in terms of a curve that's good, despite their alleged vanguardism. It seems to me that on the one hand, areas like art history are brought to an abstruse bar in order to be criticized as insufficiently relevant. But if they speak about issues of cultural politics, they're told to get back in their box,
Oh, absolutely.
the real humanities, and become irrelevant. This is an extraordinary bind, a double bind, a classic bind.
Classic.
I don't know what people in philosophy, history, art history, literary studies are supposed to do when they're told that they're guilty of two opposed things simultaneously.
No, this is a really complicated moment, I think, to be teaching in these disciplines. I mean, not the good old bad days are no better than today. But I think right now, yes, to your point, the humanities, the arts, they're told on one hand that we have to make students, quote unquote, job ready. And apparently a job in the academy or in other kinds of cultural fields isn't the answer that they're looking for. And on the other hand, we're being asked to constantly change our discipline to speak to whatever. No, let me put that differently. Where I was going with this is a little bit different. So on the one hand, we have to be jobs ready. On the other hand, I think we are recognized as the place where students learn about the complexity of culture, and that is scary. So like I think the jobs readiness thing is really a kind of ruse for why they're shutting us down. I mean, this is a little bit long-winded, but I am an alumna of the New College of Florida, which is a small public liberal arts college in Florida that was recently taken over by Ron DeSantis and his cronies. And they're turning, they say they want students to have a humanities education, but in the classical, quote unquote, sense, meaning they don't want them to learn critical race theory, they don't want them to learn feminist theory, queer theory, any kind of social cultural kind of theory that might, tarnish whatever supremacist version of the world that they're really invested in. So they say that our disciplines aren't worth anything at the same time that they're desperate to take our disciplines over again. Like our disciplines, veered in a direction, a critical direction. Now they're being either shut down or veered back, quote unquote, to classical, I think is the language that they use direction. I think that's the weird thing that's happening right now in public education, at least in the United States.
Everyone's meant to be instrumental, but not.
Yeah, they know we're instrumental, and they're into it, like when it serves their purposes.
The other day I went to the Prado here in Madrid, where of course they have Las Meninas and they have El Greco, amongst many others. And you look at El Greco and you can see Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, 100%. And you look at Las Meninas and you get the order of things, the front cover, the imagery. And then you see thousands of people lining up to look at Las Meninas because they know, like the Mona
Look
Lisa,
at it or just take a photograph of it.
or but it's something to see and to try to understand, to think about. There's something there that is not just reputation, or perhaps deriving from reputation. People are looking to note, to comprehend, to make sense of for themselves, right? As if this were a new way of looking, in just the way as you look at El Greco, And you realize Picasso couldn't have happened without this book. You know what I mean? And I see that and I think, good grief, how can anybody imagine that you can appreciate this without its social and cultural incrustation, along with the incredible avant-garde eye that is enabling it in the first instance, that all these things need to be taken into account, including all these people lined up in these huge groups wanting to get something, right? And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, please go ahead.
No, I mean, I think what's interesting when I hear you recount that is like, you do, you have lines of people who know that they're in front of something important and they want to participate, they want to read it to varied degrees, maybe they can or can't. What I find so amazing about the history of art is it is not just the history of incredible images, it's the history of a great deal of care and interpretation that a lot of people have done, and varied ways and to varied degrees of success. But like, yeah, it's this collective holding on to important things for the sake of having important and complicated conversations and things like that. And when I go into museums today, and I do believe museums need to be democratic spaces in order to be meaningful spaces, you see people lined up from who are taking time out of lives that are incredibly impacted. I have students, for instance. I took a group of students last week to the Museum of Modern Art, many of which had never been, and they literally teared up in front of some of these paintings. They literally, and it wasn't like an aura thing. It wasn't like a celebrity kind of sighting or something like that. It was just finding time to be still, to think. And it wasn't purely formal. They knew the cultural and the social kind of backgrounds of these paintings and things like that. I think that to have those experiences, you have to have access to education, you have to have access to time, you have to have days off, you have to have, like museums that don't cost more than a day's wages for you and things like that. And we, as have to fight to keep these spaces open because and meaningful and available to important and interesting ideas and not just like corporate underfunded Instagram opportunities like that, because a lot of museums are turning into that. So.
You mention aura, and places like the Louvre and the British Museum and the Met are horrendous instantiations of imperialism and colonialism. Point taken, we get it, move on without forgetting it, right? When I go to the British Museum and I see the Rosetta Stone, and again, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people wanting to see it from all over the world, including people from the Arab world, from the Asian world, from the African world. Hard to tell what their class formation is, and these museums are free of entry in the UK, more or less still. There's something going on there that is about the aura of the British Museum and its colonial legacy
Absolutely.
and its theft and looting, that people are not thinking about directly. They're thinking about it as a place that preserves things that otherwise they may not see.
Do you think that? I mean, I wonder, like, I think if, particularly if you're not going to see the quote, like, if you're not going with a art history education, like, you're not going to see the Rosetta Stone, right? You're just going to the museum. I think you're going to the museum because of the kind of institution it is, right? Because of the kind of way that it formalizes and institutionalizes all the hideous forms of power that you were just talking about. Because the aura of those objects is not explicitly like it's not individually contained. It's a network of like things. It is going to the British Museum, I think, for a lot of people. It's not going to see the quote unquote Rosetta Stone. Now, once you're there and you see something like the Rosetta Stone, I think you can depending on the way that you're navigating the museum, have the opportunity to think about, and I think a lot of people do this, like, wow, my eyes are falling upon something that eyes have been falling upon for 3,000 years and stuff like that. And it has this moment for the scale of your experience to kind of pick up, and move beyond the everyday in a way that's really important and really powerful and interesting. But I don't know that you go there if it's not the British Museum, quote unquote. So like these things are always cathedrals of, imperial and capitalist kind of power and stuff like that. But and I think we have to be really open and honest about that. And they're also, in a very complicated way, opportunities for people to have really profound and critical exposure, to things that other human beings have made by training. I mean, the Rosetta Stone is such a great example because it's important because it unlocked hieroglyphics, right? But as an object, it was just like a posting. It was a law. It was a semi. So it wasn't in and of itself a quote unquote work of art.
It's an Instagram photo of food.
So you can't appreciate, I think, the Rosetta Stone without, all of those historical and social kind of
Well, I guess
perspective.
it's apart from the British Museum, it's encrusted as an epistemological key, people are supposed to value. Prof, what I wanted to do was ask you a couple more questions, and then to conclude, throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we've said. Does that sound okay as a way of leading and ending
For
things?
sure, for sure.
And then we're going to have a little bit of gossip offline, you see.
Always good. Yes.
Which may be very brief, who knows, but it'll be fun. So, my first question of these last two is to ask you about what you see at the moment as those key aspects, going back to your opening remarks, of right-wing material culture in the US. What are you seeing, smelling, hearing, experiencing as important aspects of that formation?
Okay. Well, I think early on you asked, or I think you noted that one of the things that you found interesting about the performance of, right-wing politics in the US right now is how many cues they took from left-wing politics historically and stuff like that. And I think one of the things I'm really interested in is that line, how, like the right has been taking notes. I mean, a huge amount of social change has happened over the last few decades in the directions, in the direction of equity and stuff like that. And here are people trying to like pull that back, right? And to kind of defend against that. And so they're looking to the social movements and the protest movements and the activist projects that, advanced things to this place that's quote unquote making them uncomfortable. So I'm really interested in the ways that the right are doing things that distinguish them from the left at the same time that they are borrowing their playbooks. Like, I know this might sound pithy, but I'm really interested in the difference between a flag and a banner. Like, that's something I spend a lot of time with. The right flag, it's a flag. They wave flags. On the left, we use banners. In either case, we have these really lively, potent kinds of materials that we can hold on to, protect, fight over, and stuff like that, and care for. But the way that, they operate in one kind of side of the political spectrum versus another is interesting to me. And so I've been tracking a lot of the role that flags continue to play, at least in the United States, in a really big kind of way, and all the different places that people are like flying them from and things like that. Other forms of kind of right-wing political culture, material political culture, that's kind of interesting to me. I'm interested in, the way, the forms of costume. I'm curious to see how people dress up to, even if it is for the sake of being photographed, like what is it that's being captured, and is interesting? Are three-corner hats still trending on the right wing social media sites? I don't know. But I've been kind of paying attention to that. Also, I'd be remiss to say I'm beyond just support for this kind of idea of what patriotism looks like. On the right, I'm interested in how the right is using material culture to kind of ignite certain single issue politics, quote unquote. In particular, in a post, we were not post Roe during the last election. We are post Roe now. I'm because I think measures to either further limit or protect abortion rights are going to be so key in the election. I'm really interested to see how that gets braided into certain kinds of right-wing politics, like who's going to step away from it, who's going to really take it on, who's going to borrow from the anti-choice movement and the kind of visual material culture that they've really effectively used over the last, 40 something years. So that's something I'm tracking in a big way. So, yeah.
And last question, Prof, before throwing to you.
Yeah.
One of your areas of specialism is feminist art, which we haven't really spoken about today, though we mentioned, and I mispronounced Linda Nochlin's name,
Oh, it's
yes, her big essay, something like
Why Have
Red.
There Been No Great Women Artists?
Right, 1971, I'm
That
thinking.
sounds about right. Yeah.
New York Review of Books, I think. What's going on with feminist art now? What are the things you're talking about, you're teaching in your classes at Montclair State?
Interesting. So in feminist art history, I think well, first of all, there's a history to teach, which is exciting. And there's a history to, well, there's work to historicize, like help students understand the way that gender and sexuality were being addressed, how the discourses should, we can, really do a lot of work charting how the discourse around gender and representation has shifted, become more intersectional, become less beholden to the binary since the like women's arts movement to today, right? So that's one big thing that I think is exciting that just wasn't possible until time passed, and now time has passed. But also, I think feminist art history, like a lot of art history, is really challenging itself to be intersectional in a lot of different ways, thinking about, the intersections of race, of ability, of sexuality in ways that feminist art history hasn't always been good at. And students want to think a lot about how to represent emerging gendered subjectivities. So in terms of emerging work within the field, and emerging work in the galleries and on the streets and in the studios, like what are the artists doing, that my students in particular are interested in is I think, a lot of students are trying to find a visual language through which to express like a gender identity and formation, that's like exciting for them and doesn't have these like standard hooks to hang itself on. And a lot of my students are constantly turning to artists and thinking about how they present, like the gender sexuality knot, how they address their bodies, how they address, politics of gender and stuff like that. So, yeah, like subjects and formation. Students are really interested in that. So.
So to conclude, Prof. Archer, I'd like to invite you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed or to branch out to entirely new questions.
I don't, okay. Well, in terms of adding, yeah, I would just say, the work I'm doing is in conversation with so many really brilliant people. I think it's not just that like I have, started to write on issues of material culture and their relationship to art history, more and more people in the U. I mean, this is something the UK has been doing for a long time, in terms of like Anglophone studies, but or Anglophone art history. But more and more people are doing that work these days and are worth checking out. I think, I don't know. I think art history is trying and succeeding in a lot of ways to kind of answer the call of, how do we best understand and the politics of visual culture. I think the discipline's come a long way, so I don't want to get the impression that it hasn't. I guess I'd just say that. I don't know what else I would add. I don't know. Consume less clothing. Don't buy into fast fashion. I will say that. Yeah, I think if anything came out of this conversation that I don't think I'd articulated as explicitly was, I do think we need to think very seriously in terms of like emerging gendered subjectivities, how to make changes in consumption practices a key part of that work. I think I was glad that you steered me in a direction where we got to talk about that. And I would say that's something I'll follow up, and I hope other people do as well. I mean, I know people are thinking about that, but maybe that can be a bigger part of the conversation. So.
Thank you so much, Nicole. It was wonderful to speak to you again and to learn so much from you as I did many years ago. Really appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.